to the March 20th program of the City Club of Eugene, Building Bridges Between Races and Cultures. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marlene Nesri, City Club President. Our sponsors today are John Brown, Evans Elder and Brown, Hearing Associates, Dr. Gail Leslie, Dr. Sandy Ibarra, and Dr. Brad Smith, and KLCC. Special thanks go to KPFF Consulting Engineers for supplying our office space and to KLCC Radio for airing these programs at 6:30 on Monday nights and for archiving the podcasts on their site. A quick reminder that we host nearly 50 original nonpartisan issue programs every year. If you believe with us that civic engagement is the lifeblood of democracy, please do join us. We welcome donors, sponsors, members, volunteers, and students, anyone who has a stake in community life. Today's program, Building Bridges Between Races and Cultures, is coordinated by Joel Corin, who will introduce our speaker.
It's been 61 years since Brown versus Board of Education. It's been 50 years since Selma. Some people, even members of the Supreme Court, believe we're in a post-racial society. But incidents that happen every day and the Attorney General's report on policing practices, at least in one town, raise questions about how far we've come. Nobody is better equipped to discuss how far we've come than Dr. Lake. Dr. Lake was born or was raised in a small town 50 miles north of Memphis and was one of the first people integrated into an all-white school system where in the fifth grade. He went on to graduate first in his class in high school, Phi Beta Kappa from Willamette University in his bachelor's degree, and earning a master's and a doctorate degree from the University of Oregon. He teaches as an assistant professor of education and counseling at Northwest Christian. He teaches classes in school law, ethics and counseling, foundations in education, counseling diverse communities, elementary literacy, American thought, and now teaches a course in Black history. He is also an administrator on special assignment to the Eugene School District and works with teachers and students to improve leadership and communication. Dr. Lake lectures around the country, around Oregon, and around the country on these topics. He is a consultant with the courts and many other groups. He worked with the NAACP. He's getting nervous. He wants to start. I can tell he's ready. And Dr. Lake received the Silver Citizenship Award, the highest civilian award, from the Sons of the Revolutionary War veterans for his community work and with children and families. And I've already had one member ask me about this award. He received the award from the Sons of the Confederate Veterans and also received the Defender of Children Award from the Latino community, one of his favorite awards. Dr. Lake is a father of four and has lived in Oregon for many years, both as a student and as a teacher, and remains, however, very much a Southerner. He'd appreciate your kindness and hospitality. Dr. Lake.
Thank you all very much for the opportunity to visit with you and to talk a little bit. I know so many faces in the room that this presentation doesn't make me nervous. Thank you all for the warm welcome. My earliest years in this world were heavily informed and influenced by an old black woman of the South. As gracious and kind as any human being can be, she engaged the mind and heart of a young black child with her old sayings, tales, stories, rhymes, jokes, and poems. She created, in front of my young eyes, a world that no longer existed, and ideas that now only found grounding in her vivid imagination and sharp mind. She had been educated to only the fourth grade, but could recall many lessons, poems, and stories she had learned. She could run as fast as I could when she was already over 70 years old. She could dance and laugh with the best of them. She knew the joy of living and understood well the pain of surviving husbands and children. She had walked the road, and as she said in her last years, I could see further into the mill pond than the one who had pecked it. She was a woman who, with a slap to the face, demanded a yes, ma'am, and respect from her little dark-skinned grandchild. And she was the same woman who would humbly and without fail lower her head and say yes, ma'am, to little, young, skinny-legged white girls who were in the very same class with me. I would be astounded and furious. When asked about this incredible inconsistency, she told me, baby, in my day, we had to say that. The same old woman would then tell me, the blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice, long before anybody else thought to proclaim that black was beautiful. She would pat my little hard head and tell me, you are a pretty little black boy. I wish all my grandbabies was just as black as you are. You are a smart boy. Study hard in school. One day, you will be a smart man. She knew well how to build the self-esteem of a little child, even in a society that was very racist and very unkind. She rose each morning at 4 a.m. to prepare first a fire in an old iron cook stove and then breakfast, which always included biscuits, the best biscuits you can imagine. I can still hear her moving around her little kitchen with short, smooth steps and humming some songs to which I never learned the words, just the melody. She would cut the biscuits from the dough one by one with a baking soda can with a beautiful little white girl still on the side of the can. Without fail, she would awake everyone at 5 a.m. She said, you burn in daylight if you stay in the bed past the sunrise, according to my grandma. I wanted to start this by introducing you to the person that's responsible for the man you see in front of you. An old black woman who did only go to fourth grade because that's all they figured she deserved or needed. But she instilled in me this love for learning, this love for education. They say black boys don't value education. I can tell you that is not a deeply held cultural value to the black community, because the black community values education. In fact, my old grandma told me, if you need something for your school, if your daddy won't do it for you, baby, you come and see me. And so I go see this old woman, and she was only like 4 foot tall. I don't know if she was quite four, but she wore men's pants underneath a dress because she was a farmer, and she wasn't a play farmer. My grandma was a real farmer. She had 135 acres of land. So in those pants, she kept all the tools and everything else she needed, plus she kept her money in those pants. And I go see her, and she'd heist that dress up to get in the pocket. And she'd come out with a little handkerchief, and I can still see her old fingers getting his knots loose to get that money out of there, and she'd take out these dollars. Where do you think that woman got those dollars? She worked for her, and she would put them in my little hand. Sometimes she'd have to heist the dress and get a different handkerchief out of a different pocket. And they'd have quarters all stacked up in the end of the row. And she put those quarters in my little hand. And so when I went to school with that woman's money, guess what kind of student I was? Best student in the classroom. I had to do well for my grandma. I got A's in grades. I'd get F's in conduct a lot of times, but I got A's in grades almost all the time. In fact, one of my teachers had to go to the principal and explain, how is it this boy is getting all A's in grades and F's in conduct? How many people does it take to save a child's life? Do they even need to know it? Because I'm pretty sure my grandma told her other little grandchildren that they were pretty and that they were smart and that they were good kids and that they were going to be something one day. But guess who needed it the most? I did, because that old woman knew I was going to face challenges based on this little brown skin I had. So I grew up in Tennessee feeling really good. In fact, my first grade class, if this was it, everybody would be black, just like me. My teacher was black. In fact, my teacher was my auntie in the first grade. So I had it made in the first grade. Got to be teacher's pet. Time to go get the milk. It was me. I go get the milk for the milk break. I take my sweet time to roll milk all over the school, wherever I wanted to go. Time to take names in the class. I'm taking names. I'm mad at you. I'm going to put your name down just because I'm mad at you. And never could get in trouble in the first grade because that was my teacher. And second grade, I go in the classroom. Everybody's black in the classroom. Plus, I got a teacher who had been girlfriends my father when they were growing up, so she thought I was really, really cute. So I got to be teacher's pet in the second grade. Third grade, I went in the classroom. Everybody's black again. And this teacher, I think she escaped from the army or something because I didn't get away with anything in third grade. And at this point in my life, I can say she was a very good teacher. But at third grade, I didn't want that teacher. If I could have got a contract to bump off a teacher, it would have been that teacher. Fourth grade, I'm back in the classroom. Everybody's black again. And I got in the classroom with another teacher who had been girlfriends of my father when they were growing up. So I got to be teacher's pet in the fourth grade. By the time I was in fourth grade, how much did I know about black people, black culture? A lot. How much did I know about the white kids? I knew a little bit more than nothing. You know about those white kids? You know how they walk, know how they talk, know how they treat people, know how they act? Yeah, I know all about them. How do you know? And my brother told me. Must be right, because that's my brother. And for the white kids who grew up in an environment where everybody was white, how much did they know about white people? A lot. How much did they know about black people? You know about those black people, don't you? Know how they walk, know how they talk, know how they act, know how they treat people. How do you know about them? Well, my uncle told me. He was in the army with some of them. He said he know all about them. This is the environment I grew up in. And our books at the black school were the discard throwaway books from the white school. The bus budget oftentimes for the white school exceeded the budget for the entire school for black kids who didn't have buses at all. And we talk about making equal educational opportunities for kids. So they decided, Supreme Court, 1954, decided we're going to take all these kids from this school, we're going to take all these from this school, we're going to put them in the same school. Now, it was 67 before they even thought about integrating where I was. Now, the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, does not have the authority to integrate schools. Even with a ruling, schools were not integrated. All due speed, if you read the finding, all due speed was what they suggested. So 54 to 67, how many years is that? 13 years before you have to comply with a Supreme Court ruling. You think you get that kind of lenience from a Supreme Court ruling? And then the integration was not complete integration. It was called voluntary integration. Voluntary black kids were integrated into all white schools. Do you think it went the other way? It didn't go the other way. White kids weren't voluntarily integrated into black schools. So my mama said, you're going to the white school. I'm like, mama, please, I don't want to go to white school. I want to stay here with my cousins and my friends and all the black people. I don't want to go to the white school. But in the culture I come from, your mama tell you do something, guess what? Okay, I go to the white school. First day, and you remember my full little history now. I really like school. School is great because you have fun at school. You get to play and cut up and everything else. I go to the white school. I walk in. All the kids are lined up on the wall in chairs, sitting down, being quiet. I said, uh-oh, this is not going to be any fun. Then the teacher called my name, and I get in my little line, and I go to the room. And the first time in my little life, I'm the only black person in the room full of white people. Everybody's white. How do you think I felt? I wasn't scared. I'm tough. I'll beat up all these white people. They better not mess with me. I'm tough. I'm not afraid of white people. And this was the environment I was expected to perform in. I was a great student at the black school. All of a sudden, I'm not making straight A's. And I can't figure it out. Like, what's the difference? I know this white boy is sitting right across from me. He's not smarter than me. But they were quite advanced because of the advantages that came with having more resources, more advanced books, better teachers, all of these things. So when we think about integration and putting kids in the same schools, this was the belief. Give them the same teachers, give them the same books, give them the same learning opportunities, and we're going to produce what? Same citizens, Americans, educated American citizens. But was there an achievement gap before we integrated schools? Did anybody call it that? Did anybody even talk about the incredible disadvantage that black kids had to deal with every single day? Didn't even talk about it. But now we got them in the same schools. Now all of a sudden we got this achievement gap. Something's really wrong with these black kids. We can't educate them. I teach my students, if the color of your face determines whether you can teach a child, something's really wrong with your teaching skills. We really need to get past that, that we can only teach people who kind of look like us. Because the achievement gap, and when we think about what actually constitutes race, it's probably one of the most uninformed definitions we ever use. Because how many races are there? I'll give you a hint. How many races are there? There's actually one race. Science, anthropology, everybody has admitted there's one biological race, the human race. So does that mean race is not real? Which is where a lot of people want to go when they figure out, well, biologically, genetically, scientifically, race is not real. Well, race is not real. We don't have to talk about it. But if you consider race as a social construction, a political construction, a media construction. Look all around us. What makes race real? Us and our beliefs that there's something significantly different between me and you because of a tint of our skin color. Terrible deceit, dreadful deceit is what one scholar called it a long time ago, that our whole conception of race was called a dreadful deceit. And here in the 21st century, we still live with this dreadful deceit as if there's something significantly different. So I leave Tennessee. Somebody say, you want to go to Oregon? I said, sure, I go to Oregon. Can't be that much different than Tennessee. Remember, I'm pretty smart. I've learned all the civics. I've learned all the rights that American citizens have. And I believe this country belongs to who? Me, like everybody else. I can go to Oregon. I'm an American. Oregon's in America, right? Oh, my goodness. Did I know where I was going? No, I get to Oregon. I'm 19 years old. I got afro so big you can't even comb it. I pull it backwards. I part it. I braid it. I got a cool walk because I grew up cool. And I'm black, and I'm not ashamed of it. And so I started getting these questions about, why are you black? You think I ever heard that in Tennessee? Anybody ever walk me and say, why are you black? I mean, that shocked me the first time. What are you talking about? I said, maybe why are you white might be a better question because everybody's around here is white. And so I started thinking about that question, and I actually answered it because a lot of times it comes from children. Why are you black? They want to rub my skin. Does that come off? They love to play in my big old head of nappy hair. They'd never met anybody like me. Is that racism? Or is that curiosity? And people will say, what's wrong with your skin? Instead of me thinking something was wrong with my skin, guess what I wondered? What's wrong with you people? Where you been? You didn't get the message? I'm black, I'm smart, and I'm pretty. My grandma took care of that way back when I was about 4 or 5 years old. And if you think of this broader than the question of race, you realize that every one of our children need and deserve that same self-esteem, same belief that they are pretty, that they are smart, that they are a good kid, that they're going to be something in this life. I don't care about the characteristics. Race is just one of them. You can take a little boy with a little chubby belly. His grandma tell him, baby, that's the cutest little belly I've ever seen in my life. Which all my grandbabies had a little belly just like that one you got. All little girl with skinny legs. Baby got the prettiest little legs I've ever seen in my life. Which all my grandbabies had little legs just like yours. So if we get trapped looking at these issues as simply related to somebody's skin color, we miss the whole point. We are human beings. We are people. And the way race continues to divide this society is close to a crime. Because we still see it affecting our children. We say it's not there, but talk to the children. Ask them, are you treated differently because of your race? I'm in schools this morning. You guys know you're second on my list, right? You guys are not first on my list. The little folks are first on my list. I tell people I do progressive work with children and I do remedial work with us adults. Because we are still struggling to get past some of these things that we have learned from the culture around us. So I'm in Oregon and I'm black. And it's got not too much to do with my skin color. And I'm living in communities where they're not used to people like me. I move into a community in Salem. And I have two children of my own, and I adopted two other children. Three boys and one girl. Three black boys, one girl, in a new neighborhood, and a black man. They ever seen anybody like us? My boys, they all think they Tarzan and everything, all in the backyard, hanging ropes, swinging cross fences, ball going over in the yard to our next door neighbor, who's an older white woman, older white man. And they never spoke to us. They would work in their yard, nice flowers. I don't know how you could ignore three boys playing jungle, Tarzan, coming over your fence to get their ball and all that stuff. But they never spoke to us. And the culture I'm raised in, you respect old people anyway, no matter how they are. And I told my boys the same thing. You respect the neighbors. And they did. But one day, the old lady came out of the house running and yelling, I need some help. I need some help. I need some help. I'm willing to help. I'm like, what is it? She says, it's my husband. He's in the bathtub. He can't get out. So I go over to the house. Joel, could I pick on you?
Sure.
Come up here and take this chair. Come. Everybody else does. I go over to that house, and I go into that house for the first time since we lived there. I go in their bathroom for the first time. Her husband's in the bathtub, buck naked, had a stroke. Oh, no. No. And couldn't get out. And he's a large man. He's weighed more than I did. And he's struggling. He can't get out, and she can't get him out. So I get in the tub with him. Put your arms out. I get in the tub with him like this. And I lay down on his chest to chest, and I said, put your arms around me. And he put his arms around me, and I was able to lift him up and get him to his bed. And then we became friends. Does it take these kind of incidences for us to break these perceived barriers? Thank you, Joel, for letting me pick on you. Does it take these kind of incidences for us to break these perceived barriers? Or are there not better, easier ways to do this? And so when it comes to what I do, now I am in education. It was a hard decision because I passed the LSAT and went to go to law school and changed my mind the last minute that I did not want to spend the rest of my life in law. I wanted to spend my life in the community doing work that I thought would make a difference immediately. And I see it with our children. I see it with the adults. I see it at my work at Northwest Christian. My grandma is still the person that advises me the most. She comes into my life on every occasion that I face challenges. On the days when I don't feel like getting up to go do my work, whatever my work is, my grandma comes to mind. And she says, what you got to do this morning? Oh, grandma, I got to put a suit on and go make a speech. Get up out of bed. Get your clothes on. Smile. Be happy. Be thankful for the work you have to do. And go out and change the world. So when I got Phi Beta Kappa, guess who else got Phi Beta Kappa? When I received my PhD, guess who else got a PhD? My children said, Daddy, why are you crying? Because I was crying. Because I thought about my grandma, who probably would not even be let on a campus at Willamette University, U of O, or anywhere else. Or if they did, they would think she came to clean the bathrooms or come to do some chore. And so when we think about these things in terms of change, we have to inspire our children to look at the world as an opportunity to be better. There's a poem that I wrote about my first grade class. It's called Miss Riley's First Grade Class. In Miss Riley's funky first grade class, we learned German and French cuisines. We explored and saw the world in slick colored magazines. We felt the strange power of poetry in the dark. We captured exotic creatures at the local park. We experienced the sound of piano and heard music by the note. Our ears were thrilled majestically by simple tunes we wrote. We traveled around the whole world and never left the room. We logged thousands of dream miles on an old dusty broom. We all learned to sing as one and yet to sing alone. We learned to stand with the group or stand up on our own. We mastered the simple numbers and the common alphabet. But the greatest thing we mastered is most valuable to me yet. Miss Riley often told us, you are black children, that's true. But there's nothing in this world that cannot be mastered by you. Thank you. Dr. King was an example for me because I grew up in Tennessee and he was in Memphis when I was a little boy. And so the inspiration for much of the work I do comes from those leaders that we have lost who struggle to make this a better society. And I think this is the mandate for all of us, that we've had great examples and great models that this society can be better and should be better Do we listen? Do we follow them? Do we have the courage? It seems we are so afraid. We are so afraid to even talk about these issues. My students come to class, they are afraid to talk about race and culture. My daughter came to me and she says, Daddy, I went to see the movie 12 Years a Slave. And she says, you should go see it, but she says, don't go see it with white people. Because she says, you're going to leave there mad at them. But here's the question I want to pose to you, because my daughter posed this question to me, and as a PhD, I'm supposed to always have the answer, right? I'm supposed to have the answer. But she says, Daddy, she says, I know all about the Jewish Holocaust. She says, I even know about Anne Frank because I read that book and I did a report on it in school. But she says, this book, The 12 Years a Slave, she said, I never, ever heard of it. She says, why not? Now, what am I going to say? Why not? Why did I not hear about this story along with the stories about the Jews? Not to say that there's a hierarchy of oppressions. The Jewish tragedy is horrible. But so is what happened to African Americans here in this society. And we don't talk about it. So why do we come up empty trying to understand a Ferguson? Why does this society come up empty trying to understand what's happening in a Ferguson? And Ferguson is a small town. You guys know how small Ferguson is? Ferguson ain't no big town. It's big news, but it ain't no big town. It's a very small microcosm of what? Of the USA. And we need to take this serious, that these are issues we can do something about, and we should. But oftentimes it's posed that the person who has the least power is supposed to be the one who comes to these conversations with the answer. I work at a school where, how many black professors are there? So when people ask me, where do I teach? I say, Northwest Christian University. And they're surprised. Where? Northwest Christian University. And invariably, the second question is always, how long have you been there? Because how long am I actually supposed to last at a Northwest Christian University? In most people's minds. In fact, am I supposed to even be there? No. That's why that question, how long have you been there? And I say 8 years, and they don't have anything else to ask. But this is the dynamic of what we face as a community today, is we are still looking at representation and voices that can actually carry these conversations. So that at the basketball game at Northwest Christian, this came to me from one of my colleagues, and this may help you understand why this is a larger issue, because children have the best lens. Basketball game. Game's going great. My colleague's son is 10 years old, turns to his father and says, Dad, why are they calling all the fouls on the black players? And his dad says he was not even surprised, because that was the same thing he was wondering. Now, I brought this up to my class, where some of the basketball players are in my class, and I said, were you guys at the game? They said, yeah. I said, did you see what this 10-year-old kid saw? They're calling out and say, yeah, we saw it. I says, why didn't you guys say anything? And the whole room was quiet. I says, why did you guys say anything? They said, well, it wouldn't make any difference anyway. So I said, let me get the picture here. You got an arena full of adults, accomplished adults, professors, administrators, adults, coaches, everybody else, sitting in that arena looking at the same thing this 10-year-old saw, but the only person who had the courage to speak about what they saw was who? A 10-year-old child. And see, Christianity says we should see through the eyes of our children. We should see through the eyes of our children. A great Chinese philosopher says the great person who never loses their child's heart. Einstein says, in pursuit of truth and beauty, you are permitted to remain a child all of your days. So what the messages our children are giving us? How is it it's only a 10-year-old child who's willing to say what they see? And the rest of us act like we don't see it. And it goes on. And can the black basketball player say anything? If he does, oh, there he go, playing the race card. Or they end up in even more difficulties because of daring to give voice to what they experience. And this is a silence that I want to challenge everybody in this room about that goes on in a community like ours. We know these things. We see these things. What do we do about these things? And silence is not a good answer. The exceptional society that we have inherited, this democracy, did not start out as a democracy. It's only been through the struggle of typically the people who were most excluded. Women, people of color, poor people. And yet we see that same dynamic as we continue to struggle. This conversation is one that 30 minutes does not even do it justice. In fact, the typical course does not do it justice. Which in our universities, how many diversity courses do students get? This is almost a joke, even with the students. One, and that's enough, right? That's sufficient. And it's not. And so we need to change the model that we use to do this work. We do conferences. We do great conferences. How often do we do them? Once a year. What happens in between? Nothing. Come back to the next conference. So our models are not sufficient to meet the needs of a community that's changing as dynamically and as fantastically as our communities are changing. And leadership needs to be at the front of these issues, not behind them. Typically, they come from the street or from our students, but leadership needs to be at the front of these issues. I guess I'll just take my last minute to say that this community has an opportunity, I think, an opportunity to improve itself. We talk about Ferguson. We talk about Oklahoma. These are conversations we all will have. But we need to have conversations about our own community and how we can work together to improve what happens here. Our children raise these questions. I'll give you last example. I'll show you how you can do this. And I'll show you through the eyes of a four-year-old. Two four-year-olds. I'm a Northwest Christian. I'm coming out and going to do a chore. Coming in are two little girls, blonde, brunette. And they walk by me, and when they walk by me, they walk by like this. They haven't been that close to somebody who looked like me. And I went and did my chore, and I came back, and ironically, guess who I run into coming back? Same two little girls and their grandmother. And again, they staring at me, and something in me said, I need to talk to these two little girls. So I said, who are you little girls? Are you new students? They're like, no, we're not new students. We're too little to be new students. No, you could be new students here. Oh, no, we're not. I said, yes, you could. You could be new students here. In fact, you'll be as smart as any other students in my class. I said, how old are you? She says, I'm four. I said, how old are you? She says, I'm four. I says, wait a minute. Are you twins? They're like, no. I said, well, both of you can't be four. One of you got to be five. One of you got to be three. Come on, tell me the truth. Both of you can't be four. We both are four. Are you twins? No. Well, you both can't be four. Yes, we are. We both are four. I said, okay, I'll let you be four. And the little brunette, she says, we hug and kiss. And the grandma heard that. She thought she had to explain it. Grandma says, well, in our family, we hug and kiss. And I said to the little girl, I said, well, that's really good, because in my family, we hug and kiss, too. I said, you going to give me a hug? Mm-mm. By that time, the little blonde had walked up closer, and she reached out, and she touched my skin. And she says, why are you black? I said, my father's skin's color about the same color as mine. I said, I bet your father's skin color about the same color as yours. End of conversation. As long as I've had that question for all these years, guess what? With a child, I've never had to go any further than what you just got, so I hope you guys can get it. It may be too complex for you. My father's skin is about the same color as mine. Oh, she got it. Then she moved a little bit closer. I said, you gonna give me a hug? Gave me a little bear hug. Now, as an educator, a child comes in. She sees something unknown to her. Unknown so much that it captures her attention and she stares. While they were in there, you think they forgot about me? Probably going through their head is, what in the world was that man? Who is that? What's wrong with his skin? And all the questions a little four-year-old could have was probably kicking around in their head. Fortunately, they run into me on the way back out. And then they get to have a conversation with me. And I play with kids, so it made it a little more comfortable for them to play with me. And they got a little attitude because they both are four, and they want to tell me they're four, and I can't change their age. Then she came closer to me. What courage did that take for a four-year-old to approach the unknown? And then not only approach, but reach out and do what? Touch my skin. Now, that's gaining knowledge. She touched my skin and she learned something. And what did she learn by touching my skin? That it was the same as hers. She processed that information how quickly? Did she take 6 weeks? Did she take a semester, a term, a year? How quickly did that baby process that information? Soon as she got it. And what did she do with it? She hugged this big old man whose skin is still black. What is wrong with us? Why are we adults so recalcitrant and so difficult to move past these simple, powerful issues of respecting each other as common human beings? Thank you all very much. Time's up.
Thank you for bringing clarity and vision to the City Club program. Our topic today is building bridges between races and cultures. Our speaker is Dr. Johnny Lake. We'll break for a few minutes now to formulate questions and come back.
You're tuned to KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, KLFR Reedsport 89.1, and at 88.1, KLFO Florence, KLBR Bend, KMPQ Roseburg. We're on the web at klcc.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and we have an app for your smartphone or tablet. This is KLCC, NPR for Oregonians.
Welcome back to the March 20th City Club program, Building Bridges Between Races and Cultures. Our guest speaker is Dr. Johnny Lake. City Club members, please identify yourselves and keep your questions to about 30 seconds each. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Milne.
Hi.
So I agree with you about talking with each other is a really good way to break barriers. And I'm wondering what you think, if anything, about the Starbucks campaign that's out there now. It's Race Together, and it's supposed to encourage conversation. Do you think those things, aside from the practicalities of whether someone can have that kind of conversation while making coffee or wanting coffee, but is it a good starting point? Do you think those kinds of efforts are helpful?
I think the intent of the action of Starbucks is admirable, I would say. And if you think of it in the backdrop of the silence that exists in this society about race, you understand why it may seem provocative that they suggest that we talk about what? Something that nobody really wants to talk about. So from that perspective, and I guess that's the political sense of it, I think their intention was a good one. But when you think on the other side of it, and for the other educators in the room, how competent are people at having conversations about these complex issues? I give a pop quiz in my class, and now that's three questions. Define race, define culture, define ethnicity. If I gave that pop quiz in here, how many people would pass it? Maybe a couple of educators who have navigated these conversations. But in general, most people confuse all three of these things with each other. And a lot of times when we think we're having a conversation about race, we're actually having a conversation about culture. Ethnicity, if you review the meaning of that word, never was about race, and it's become the fair substitute for race. So when we talk about ethnicity, and we have coded it so much, so my students, I go to the board and I put education. What is education? And then I put multicultural education. Who is this for? Do you get the code? Already in the code, multicultural education. Is this about white people? No. We already know that. And so the subtleties of this is, I think, what, giving them best credit for their action, what Starbucks was trying to surface is this very necessary conversation about these constructs.
I've really enjoyed your talk about race and culture.
Thank you.
And I was going to tip it towards culture myself.
Okay.
I grew up in a time when a black doctor... I'm sorry.
That's all right.
He couldn't come to my house to save my dying grandfather.
That's right. Mm.
As I was older, I had to confront a real estate market that prohibited sales of homes to persons of any color but white. Some of these things are better now, but the prejudice didn't go away. Now, isn't it illegal to let the homeless poor sleep at night in Eugene? Martin Luther King worked to make these things better for all the poor, regardless of race.
Amen.
Isn't there still much more to do?
Oh, my goodness. Powerful. Thank you, Jared. Good to see you. And thank you for the question and the complexity of the question. Because this is why it's so difficult for so many people, because the complexity often escapes us. The goal for me when I work with students in order to develop some competency in dealing with these issues is to be able to see through the multiple lenses of identity that ends up disserving people. So there's a relationship between gender and race and class and ability, sexual orientation, and all of these things. There is a relationship between these things, even though they're not the same. So when our class yesterday, we were talking about the women's rights movement, and we had this great picture of these women all dressed like men, smoking cigarettes, and the guy was holding the baby, and the woman was chewing him out, and all of this. This was the 1800s now, and they were showing how women were trying to be like who? Men. In my class, nobody saw this, but I asked the question. I said, well, where are the women of color? So here you have an intersection of gender and what? Gender and race, because the black women were not in that women's movement, wasn't even considered in that. That's why Sojourner Truth had to make a speech, "Ain't I a Woman?" And so this compromise between these identities has often been one that's made so that when we talk about the homeless, let's say the poor, and that includes the homeless. Let's say the poor in a society that's a democracy. Do they deserve to have food? I do this with the kids. This is where I've learned my lessons, is from the kids. Who should get food in a society like us? Well, the people who obey the law, the people who contribute to society, the people who do what they're supposed to do. And one girl way in the back, she says, "Anybody who was hungry, Dr. Lake?" I'm like, is that true? Could we get consensus in this room that if somebody in our community is hungry, they should get some food? What do you think? Let me see hands. If somebody is hungry, they should get some food. What about water? That's something a human being needs to live too. Should a person get a drink of water? And it's hard to get consensus in our communities. Move on to education. Who deserves to get an education? Who deserves some health care? Who deserves a home? Do you see how simple it is to answer some of these questions, except for the fact that these identities have been used? One of the theories I use is differences as deficits. Once we identify someone as different, it automatically creates them as a deficit. Race has been used that way. Gender has been used that way. Sexual orientation is used that way. Poverty is used that way. And this is something that I would ask you to think about, because we are all complex creatures. We have privilege and unprivilege oftentimes at the same time. So there are women in this room who have privilege at the same time as, guess what? As a woman, you will be disadvantaged in situations. There are people of color in here who have privilege as a male, but also maybe have unprivilege as a male of color. And these things still play out inside our institutions and in our organizations in ways that call us to the question, what do we do? If you are a privileged character, you have the power to help address these issues, and it should be your voice that's the first one heard, not the person who's not privileged. The way we've structured it is we always make the weakest party the one responsible for raising the question, rather than the one who sits there quiet. As King said, silence at some point becomes betrayal. Silence at some point becomes betrayal. And another scholar said, silence in the middle of a crisis says you are either a coward or a traitor, and that there's not any other place to land. And so in these conversations, you have a place to play, a voice to use in these conversations. And oftentimes it's as simple as asking the question. You know that? We think we always have to have the answer. But sometimes just asking the question, What are we doing about the achievement gap for kids of color? What are we doing about the homeless in our community? And not accepting silence for an answer. And keep asking that question. So you didn't get an answer last time at your city council or wherever else? Go back next time and ask the same question. Ask the same question. Somewhere down the line, they're going to be accountable for that same question. And it's the commitment of a community, the commitment of a community to create equity in a community that makes these things happen. Thank you. And your story about the doctor just resonates with what I grew up with. Because there were white doctors, there was one white doctor who would work in the black community growing up, when I grew up. But there were no black doctors. And so many times people suffered because they could not get proper medical care. All of these lessons from the past, I think we have to take them as serious lessons for the present. Because these things still happen, but nobody's going to say it's because of race like they used to. It may be because they don't have an insurance card, or they don't have some money, or there's a da-da-da, whatever the excuse, there's not one good enough for us to not help the less fortunate in our community.
Dr. Leake, I'm Mary Layton, member of City Club. So our table was curious about, in a professional context, mm-hmm. what do you teach new teachers, wannabe teachers, to do? How do you teach them to open people's hearts and minds to the possibilities of the children in front of them without nurturing existing biases or boundaries? And where do you see in the classrooms you visit, like this morning, where they were presumably experienced teachers, what are the practices that teachers can use to help children to not perpetrate the bad practices that we have sometimes used to divide people instead of unite them?
Teachers are the fulcrum for these conversations right now. No Child Left Behind, we was in it for 13 years, and we decided it wasn't working after 13 years, and so we throw it out, and now we focus on the teachers, and if we can make really better teachers, then we're going to have better outcomes for kids. And I tell you, keep your eye on this initiative as well, because there's no one factor in the school that actually makes or breaks the educational opportunity for a kid. The teacher is crucial. That was my research in my PhD, was looking at how important the relationship is between a teacher and a student. But as Goodlad, one of the biggest researchers in education, says there's an array of factors affecting what happens to a child in school. Now, if the sun's shining on you, how many rays are hitting you? And another scholar says it's a concentration of factors, which means it's not one, it's not two, it's not three, it's not four, it's not five, it may be 10, all at the same time. So you run in and you take care of one, what happens for the child? They still fail. And we're like, well, what happened? We took care of the problem, when really you only took care of one issue. And so with my students, I challenge them to become the lens for what they deliver to their students. And this starts with you first understanding who you are in this conversation, which privilege has allowed most privileged people to be invisible in these conversations. So if I say, we got some gender problems in the City Club, anybody gonna look at the men? Does anybody think the men got the problem? There's some gender problems in the City Club. Do they think the men got the problem? The women might. Okay, I see women heads nodding, but I don't see no men heads nodding at all. We don't think of gender as belonging to who? Men. When we say, well, we got some race problems here in this community, we got race problems at NCU or anywhere else, do we think of the white people there? Do you see again how we are coded to think of these things as belonging only to the victims of the issue? And so with my students, and I praise my students who come to Northwest Christian University with the intent to be teachers and counselors, but I teach them that you are the vehicle for everything you deliver to a child. And how well do you know your vehicle determines how well you will be successful. And if the color of your face determines whether you can teach a child, you need some new skills. And so when it comes to these issues, especially race and culture, these identities that are so volatile in our communities, this is the way I introduce to my students, is that this is an arrangement. That this class is a setup. You saw the class,
You signed up. They asked me to teach it. I said, yes, I showed up. You're here. I'm here. This is a setup. This is an arrangement. Now, in this situation, you get to practice your skills as a teacher or as a counselor in this arrangement, and it is an artificial setting. So there's no kids here that you're going to hurt. There's no parents who are going to come and be looking to kick you in the butt. There are newspapers not going to report on what you say or do in this class. So I expect you to be courageous and to practice your skills in this context. This is your laboratory. And if you do that well enough, you might pass this class. If you don't, I can tell you right now, you will not pass this class. Because if you can't do it in this classroom, what does that tell me about when you go out into the real classroom, where you have real children and real families and real community? This is your practice. So be courageous. Learn and engage these issues, and you will become competent as a teacher and a counselor. If you choose not to, you should probably find another career.
Good afternoon. It's good afternoon. Very good to have you here.
My name is
Judy Sawyer.
Hi, Judy.
Our table is interested in whether you have found any ways to bring groups of people together, whether black and white or groups that are disparate, that in ways that would address race, privilege, and that kind of thing. I'm thinking, for example, what if a whole city were to decide, the churches, black and white churches, mm-hmm. to get together to take a page from Dr. King?
Yes.
As an example, have you found any ways to bring people together to make them want to talk and deal with each other about these things?
I've been engaged in the churches here in Oregon and in Washington for some time, because they are great venues for having real conversations. And I applaud some of the churches that I've worked with there was one in Salem. I've worked with Unitarian Church and Friends Church, and they invited me to speak, and they made a poster. And they were getting ready to put on the poster anyway. The friend who invited me was white. And he said in the meeting, he said, Johnny, I had the hardest time explaining something to these people. I'm like, what is it? He says, well, they want to put on the poster Johnny Lake, a black man who lives in Salem, on the poster. And he says, I told them that wasn't appropriate. And they said they couldn't understand why not. He's a black man who lives in Salem. And he says, they didn't get it until I turned it around for them. If a white man was coming here to speak, would you put on the poster so-and-so, so-and-so, a white man who lives in so-and-so? And he said they understood it. And so in those contexts, it seems we can be more honest about some of the dilemmas that show up with our perceptions about these issues. Creating these conversations in the communities, I have facilitated some very powerful conversations in communities, but oftentimes the very people who need to be there aren't there. In fact, they don't want to be there. They prefer to be somewhere else. And so that indicates the failure of leadership to actually take ownership for a lot of these issues. I don't think any of us are experts to the point that we don't say the wrong thing. Anybody ever made a mistake? See your hand. Made a mistake? You ever said anything you shouldn't have said? Ever said anything you shouldn't have said? You knew you shouldn't have said it, went on and said it anyway? In these situations, we have to be willing to make those mistakes and learn from those mistakes. And if I were you, I would challenge your leadership in your community who say that they are leadership to take some ownership and some responsibility for moving these conversations forward. Dialogue, communication helps. Even if it's difficult, it actually helps. But we tend to shy away from that. And so I would say creating those opportunities is one of the things I try to get my students to understand is you are in a dialogue with other people, whether you want to be or not. And so take advantage of that dialogue. So when I walk in a room, the envelope's open for me in many cases. Why are you black is not an odd question in our communities. I was in Elkton yesterday. When I tell people I'm going to Elkton, guess what they say? You going where? Kind of like what I say when I'm going to the City Club. You going where? Or Burns, or LeGrand, or most of the places around Oregon. What are you doing there? But if I say I'm going to Northeast Portland, does anybody say, why? Do you see how this stuff is coded? Coded so deeply that we don't even think about what we're saying before we say it. It's usually out of your mouth before you think about it. And so I would say encourage the leaders and people who have influence or organizations to sponsor real conversations. We do need them.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Michael Kerrigan. What should, and thank you for being here today. What an honor.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And what should white allies be doing to challenge racism in Lane County? What are the most effective, the most courageous things we can do?
Wow. The white-only signs are gone. I think everybody knows that. The overt is out of bounds. You see it in the media. Let somebody slip and say the wrong thing. What happens to them and their job? Guy just got fired for comparing Michelle Obama to what? Planet of the Apes. Said she could have been in the cast of the Planet of the Apes. What happened to his job? He's gone. So one scholar calls it the ruckus of individual racism. And it's the right term. The ruckus of individual racism prevents us from actually talking about the silence of institutional racism. So we respond quickly to the ruckus. So Oklahoma University is a great example. How quickly did we respond to that? Is that the first time that song ever been sung? What you think? First time. First generation, do you think? First generation ever sung that song. So why is it such a big outrage? Because somebody found out about it. Because it became public. Now all of a sudden we all ashamed. So totally ashamed that we got to kick two students out of University of Oklahoma. There you go, we fixed it. Solve the problem, right? Or should it not be more concerning to us, how do we raise young men through our K-12 and all the way through college to continue to be that ignorant and that racist and not be accountable for it, even to each other? That is the concern. And when we look at our community, you should ask the same question. There's one of my favorite teachers who's on leave because of racism that happened to her in the school district. And the question I posed to her when I talked to her about it, I says, well, you know, I know you have difficulty with this, but think about this child. How did we raise a young man in this school district without helping him to be free of this racist attitude and perspective about you as a teacher? And so when you think of education as the key, education means to lead out of ignorance. And if we are truly educating our children, we lead them out of ignorance. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Veronica Amaya, City Club member since 2013. And my question was regarding, in light of Ferguson and incidents like that that you're referring to, how do you recommend dealing with observing things that do seem racially motivated from law enforcement? And how do we as citizens approach issues of that nature?
Police issues are incredibly difficult because their job is incredibly difficult. And we don't call them when we're having a party. We usually call them when we have a problem. And so they tend to be problem-oriented. But the lens through which police look are the same lens that the rest of us look. They're human beings. They see through the same lens, and they respond oftentimes to their already held beliefs and attitudes about things. And so the work with the police has to be community work. And the police is a community member. In fact, they are a public servant. And this maybe don't go over too well, but they are to serve the public. And that public includes all of our citizens, not just some of our citizens. And so that engagement with the police has to be a close one. I've experienced this ever since I was in Oregon. My first week in Oregon, I was pulled over by the police. My boys, my oldest boy pulled over 7 times the first year driving, never got a ticket. And so the chief was, I guess we could call ourselves friends. Our conversations weren't too friendly, but we stayed engaged because I had 3 boys, he had 3 boys. And I challenged him. I said, if your boys came home and said somebody did something to them that they thought was really unfair, I said, what would you do? He said, I would do something about it. I said, well, I'm the same kind of father you are. And I said, that's why I'm talking to you, because this is going to change. My boys are not going to be afraid of getting pulled over just because they are of color. And I think that close working relationship with the police as I had conversations with many officers, because I'm not shy about talking to people. And officers said, well, we'd like to get to know you better, too. And I'm like, well, yeah. And I said, you know, it's your job and my job to make sure if there are officers who are not doing their job properly, we get rid of them. You know, so there's a shared responsibility here that I think we need to call each other to account, the police and the community. So if there are some officers who are not doing their job, I said, you know who they are anyway. I said, go to any job and ask them, who's the mess ups in this job? Can they tell you? Everybody can tell you that quick. I said, you know, too. And he says, yes, we do know, but the chief knows too. And so these structural issues sometimes make it difficult to make change, but as a community, we have every right to ask the police to participate with us fully in these conversations about equitable treatment for our community. And that takes courage. That takes courage for people. People sometimes are afraid to talk to the police. But we need to create those opportunities as we talk about the others, about race, gender issues, any of these other issues. We need to create those spaces where we can have these conversations, and the leadership in our community should fully support that.
Thank you so much, Johnny Lake, for bringing clarity and vision to this City Club program, Building Bridges Between Races and Cultures. I want to let the radio audience know that a handout that Professor Lake here gave us for 10 strategies for confronting issues of prejudice and discrimination, 9 strategies for dealing with racist comments, will be available on the City Club website in a few days. Thanks again to our sponsors, John Brown, Hearing Associates, and KLCC. We meet again on March 27th at the Downtown Athletic Club for Perspectives on the Future of Forest Management with guest speakers Matt Fehrenbacher and Mark Barnes. Lunches for this program can be ordered on City Club's website or by contacting the office. Thanks so much, everybody. Thank you for being here.